WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today I'll be talking to the novelist Jennifer Egan, and we'll find out about a side of the cartoonist Roz Chast that really none of us expected.
And they were always inspecting our ukuleles.
For drugs. Because we did used to keep our drugs in the ukulele, along with the gum and the tissues.
More on that later. But we're going to start off just up the street, about a mile north of the World Trade Center, at the Trump Soho. The building launched at a pivotal moment for Donald Trump. 2006 was not a good year for him at all. He had lost control of his casinos, and he wasn't really building a lot. Trump was becoming more of a branding enterprise. But in the spring of 2006, on the season finale of The Apprentice, he makes a big announcement.
Located in the center of Manhattan's chic artist enclave, the Trump International Hotel and Tower.
His first building in New York in years. The Trump Soho was going to be 43 stories in Lower Manhattan, not exactly in Soho, as a matter of fact, but close enough. Donald Jr. and his sister Ivanka had signed papers incorporating as Dunka Soho to develop the property.
Never before us had there been a building that fit aesthetically within the downtown environment.
For zoning reasons, though, this wasn't the usual luxury tower. It was a strange hybrid of hotel and condo, and it turned out to be a tough sell at nearly $2 million a pop. And they were trying to sell it just as the financial crash hit. I'm going to let staff writer Adam Davidson, who's reported extensively on Trump's businesses, take us back to 2006 and explain precisely what happened.
So the Trump Soho, this is not just another project for Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. This is not just one more and dozens of projects. This is crucial. This is when the Donald Trump, as public figure, as famous New York real estate developer, as brand, has never been more famous, more heralded. And it's when Donald Trump, as actual developer, has never been less successful. His big play in casinos is crumbling right at that time. He's lost, by this point, majority ownership of his casino business, and the casinos themselves would all close in their third and final bankruptcy just a few years later. Trump Soho is his first major project, high-profile project in Manhattan in many years. He needs this thing to succeed. The stakes are really high.
And the stakes are actually even higher because...
Oh, wait, let me introduce you. This is Andrea Bernstein from WNYC.
So the stakes are even higher because for the first time, he's bringing his children, Ivanka and Don Jr., in on a project in a big way. So their names are on the documents underlying the building. And at the same time, Ivanka Trump, in particular, is becoming a TV star herself. She is becoming a personality on The Apprentice. So all of that is happening. It's not just a high-stakes project for Donald Trump. It's a high-stakes project for the Trump family.
For the next generation. And I should say, Andrea Bernstein, you are talking to us because you, along with Jesse Eisinger. Hi, Jesse.
Hello. How are you?
How are you? You are star reporter at ProPublica.
Yes, I like that.
All right. You are an okay reporter at ProPublica.
Sure.
Okay.
You're somebody.
And headlines in the New York Post, Daily News, and who knows where else saying Trump's latest building a flop. This would be disastrous.
Absolutely. And in fact, pretty quickly, it turns out that it is a flop. It's a project that is very difficult to sell, almost impossible to sell. It's downtown in Manhattan, which and fancy condos, which should be an attractive proposition, except that the zoning laws prohibit actual condos to be built in this part of what they're calling Soho, which isn't really Soho. It's right next to the exhaust-filled Holland Tunnel. And so they have to sell a kind of condo slash hotel room where you're only allowed to stay in it for 120 days a year, and you get to change nothing about the room. So essentially, you have a hotel room.
Great. Let's hear from Rudy Sieber. He was one of the brokers who was trying to sell it, and you spoke with him.
The units were quite small, very small, actually. It had a not even kitchenette. Basically, you only had a sink and a microwave. That was it. You had insane carrying charges. And also,
all right, so weird proposition, not selling well, stakes are huge. How is it going?
Badly. It's going badly. But the Trumps and their brokers are saying it's going really well. The Trumps start to say there's 31% sold, and then their brokers say it's 53% sold. And then Ivanka Trump and Eric Trump and Donald Jr. hold a press conference in 2008 for the foreign press. And they talk about how great it's going. And Ivanka Trump says 60% of the units are sold. 60%. But we know from a sworn affidavit that one of the other partners filed later with the Attorney General's office that there were actually not even 15% sold.
Why say anything at all? Why not just tout the benefits? We have a great gym. We have, you know, the restaurant's amazing.
Are you familiar with the Trumps?
Yeah.
Because of the thing that you said, Adam, the stakes were really high. This building had to succeed. It could not fail. And it was in a terrible economic market. And what we were told is that potential buyers are in fact bringing this up all the time. This is what Rudy Sieber, the broker, told us.
Every client is always going to ask, how well has the building sold? Why? Because they want to have the certainty that they're not the only ones that are, you know, dumb enough to want to buy.
So a civil suit is filed by some of the buyers who have researched the Trump statements. They've researched the affidavit, and they are accusing the Trumps and their business partners in the Trump Soho of a consistent pattern of outright lies.
And that's a quote from the lawsuit.
Correct. And then the DA's office sees this in the paper, and they start an investigation.
All right, so this is a big moment. I mean, a civil suit, New York real estate, there's probably 1,000 civil suits a day. The Trumps, the Trumps are sued constantly. But a criminal complaint, explain that. How could this be criminal?
Right, so this is the Manhattan DA opening up a criminal investigation into the Trump Organization. And, of course, crimes are more serious than civil suits and more serious than civil complaints from the government. You can go to prison.
It's also worth saying that Donald Trump has been involved in 4,000 civil lawsuits, according to USA Today, but not charged with a crime. His family not charged with a crime. So this would be a significant turn for the Trumps.
So they start this investigation more or less right when the civil lawsuit is filed in August 2010. And they have a very serious investigation that goes on for a while and starts to focus in on Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr.
So we ended up talking to 20 people who knew about the case. And in particular, 7 people who had seen email evidence of what the Trump children had said, and from what they told us, made the prosecution believe that there might be some very serious crimes committed by the Trumps, including fraud and larceny.
And the essence of the emails were that they appeared to prosecutors to show intent, that they knew that they were lying and did it anyway.
So these prosecutors have these emails. Walk me through what the next steps are.
Sure. So these investigations go slowly and carefully, and the Trumps assemble a high-powered defense team made up of two well-known criminal defense lawyers, Gary Naftalis of Kramer Levin and Paul Grand of Morvillo Abramowitz.
Who is the son-in-law of the former district attorney, Robert Morgenthau, very famous, and the former law partner of the current district attorney. So that is the caliber of the legal team that the Trumps have.
Exactly. And Grand is representing one of the brokers, and they start to have a series of meetings with the prosecutors to make their case. And the defense essentially is, well, we didn't really lie in a significant or material way. This was puffery.
Puffery.
And puffery is a legal term. Puffery.
That is, really?
Yeah. Puffery is a legal term.
As we've come to learn.
puffery means a kind of harmless lie, or you can say this is the greatest hot dog on Broadway. And you can also say this is the Trump Soho when it's not in Soho. What you can't do is lie about something that's materially important to the sale of a security or condo. So the question really was, you know, the defense said, look, the building is built. The condos are there. This isn't some swampland in Florida. Where's the fraud here? And everybody got their money back, or the money was in escrow. So nobody's out a lot of money. No harm, no foul, no crime. That's what the defense is saying.
But, I mean, to me, as you guys said, saying 60% were sold when 15% were sold, this clearly feels like it crosses the line.
Well, we know that a lot of people in the Manhattan DA's office thought so, too. But there's another problem that gets introduced, which is that the civil suit is settled, and the buyers get 90% of their deposits back, but the Trumps get something, too. What the Trumps get is a promise by the victims that they won't cooperate with prosecutors.
So, willingly.
Is that legal? Are you allowed to ask somebody not to participate in a criminal prosecution?
Well, this gets to whether the DA was aggressive enough, because the DA could have put pressure on them to rescind this.
And this is the point where the defense team starts to escalate into the spring of 2012, when we now know the Manhattan DA's office was seriously considering impaneling a special grand jury. So that's a big deal, because when you get to a special grand jury, the likelihood is that the next step is indictment.
All right. And this is the moment in the story where in comes Mark Kasowitz. Explain who Mark Kasowitz is.
Mark Kasowitz is a civil attorney who represents corporations mostly, and at this point has represented Donald Trump personally for about a decade.
And still does.
And still does today.
So confusing why at this key moment they have an all-star criminal defense team, they're about to face a possible grand jury, and they go with a civil guy.
Right. So the Trump Organization adds Mark Kasowitz to the team, and Kasowitz goes straight to Vance.
You mean Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney?
Correct.
And Kasowitz has a connection to Vance.
So Kasowitz has made a contribution to Vance. He's made a $25,000 contribution in January of 2012. So just to place that in time, the civil suit is settled in November 2011. Kasowitz makes a $25,000 contribution in January. In May is the meeting with Vance.
And just to be clear, the Manhattan DA runs for election to become the Manhattan
right.
DA.
Oh,
yes, he's running for his reelection. Kasowitz is now in the top donors of Cy Vance. So he calls up Cy Vance in the beginning of May, and he says, can I have this meeting?
Jesse, you talked to Cy Vance about this?
Yeah, we both, Andrea and I both did.
Thankfully, I have a sort of a vetting process and a vetting team, and the fact that he had contributed previously before he had said he was coming into the litigation, and a decision was made to return the $25,000 simply to avoid any appearance of, you know, of conflict.
So he returned the contribution. So it was okay to meet with Kasowitz. Then, 3 months later, Vance closes the case.
At the end of the day, I did not believe that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime had been committed. I was not sure that I knew that a crime had been committed. After 24 months, I felt that we had to bring the inquiry to a close and I had to make a call.
But what our reporting shows is that there was a generalized belief up and down the DA's office, right up to the level of Cy Vance, that they should proceed forward with this prosecution.
The line prosecutors did believe there was a crime committed, right?
There was debate, I think discussion and analysis in the office about whether or not a crime had been committed and whether or not it should be charged as a crime.
Was there somebody strongly against bringing the case?
And we can't go into all the deliberative process. We have great lawyers. I respect them. But at the end of the day, I have to look at all the evidence and weigh all the factors as the lead of the office and my name's on the indictment as to whether or not I feel this should be prosecuted as a crime. Not every lie is a crime.
Yeah, so he overruled the rest of the office.
And let's just say in his heart of hearts, we take him at his word, he just didn't think this was the right case to bring. Wouldn't he know it looks bad that his number one donor or one of his top donors had met with him to recommend that he stop this case and then he stops the case?
A month after Vance closes the case, Kasowitz gets back in touch and says, I'd like to hold a fundraiser. And Kasowitz does hold a fundraiser in January of 2013. So this is 5 months after the case has been closed. And he gives an even bigger donation to Vance, almost $32,000 this time. And over the course of the next year, he raises $50,000, effectively doubling his initial contribution.
So this looks terrible. This, I mean, not knowing Vance's thought process, this looks awful.
Vance argued strongly that he made the decision on the merits and that he was uninfluenced by Kasowitz. And by the way, Kasowitz says the same thing. He said he made a donation because he respects Cy Vance. He respects his work.
I actually have Kasowitz's exact words here.
Yes, very Trumpian. I was.
Yeah. I donated to Cy Vance's campaign because I was and remain extremely impressed by him as a person of impeccable integrity, as a brilliant lawyer, and as a public servant with creative ideas and tremendous ability. I have never made a contribution to anyone's campaign, including Cy Vance's, as a quid pro quo for anything. That was an email Mark Kasowitz sent to us. So the timing of this second Kasowitz contribution really is confusing to me. I mean, it makes total sense that the Manhattan... I mean, I think it's insane that the Manhattan DA is soliciting contributions from defense lawyers at all, but saying, okay, but I don't take any money from anyone who has a case before me, it seems even more so, or whose case has been dropped by me recently. That seems like a crucial...
We asked him about that.
It would not be wise to take a donation 24 hours after a case is concluded with a determination not to prosecute. I think that's obvious. 5.5 months is a whole different matter, and it seems to me a reasonable amount of time.
2 weeks? Is it 3 months? Where's the line where it becomes acceptable?
The line, I think, there is no bright line, Jesse, but I think the line is drawn by practice. The practice is the four step of the vetting process. And if those in the vetting process who had looked at this Kasowitz donation felt it was inappropriate at that time, I think they would have told me. That's not what happened. And look, I think having the issue of that second donation has not been an issue, as far as I knew, and wasn't an issue in my vetting team's or my office's mind until several weeks ago. But I'm perfectly happy to return that money either and plan to either to Mark or to some appropriate criminal justice organization, because the money isn't that significant to me, and I don't want the money to be a millstone around anybody's neck, including the office. But it was not flagged internally as something that should be returned, but I'm I completely understand the interest that you have in sort of the TikTok and who said what when, and feel the smart thing to do is to either return it to Mark or to some charity.
So that's his argument.
Right.
We're not alone in thinking that this was questionable. Paul Grand, who we spoke of earlier, Grand is representing one of the brokers, said to us that this meeting, quote, didn't have an air you'd like. And he said, if you or I were the district attorney and a guy comes in out of the blue and wants to meet with you and he's campaign donor and the other two lawyers are nowhere to be seen, you would think twice about it. So Paul Grand himself thought this was the right decision made in a questionable fashion.
Wow.
The coda is that Kasowitz goes around now telling people that he's the one that saved Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. from a really dangerous investigation.
Kasowitz denies ever saying anything like that, by the way.
And if you imagine the counterfactual here that Ivanka and Donald Trump had been charged, the world would be a different place.
It seems unlikely that Trump would have been able to run for president or would have chosen to.
I think it would have been impossible with two indicted children on his own big marquee project.
That's Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica, along with Andrea Bernstein of the WNYC Newsroom. They spoke with The New Yorker's Adam Davidson. As of today, just over 30% of the units in the Trump Soho have sold. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A lot of people first heard the name Jennifer Egan when her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2011. But Egan was not an overnight success. This was her fourth novel, and she published her first story in the New Yorker nearly 30 years ago. But she's kept innovating since then, including a short story written entirely in tweets called Black Box. Compared to that, Jennifer Egan's new novel, Manhattan Beach, is a kind of departure. It starts during the Depression, and it's about a girl who goes to work in a shipbuilding yard in Brooklyn during the Second World War. It involves false identities, a possible murder, and the mob. It's kind of an old-fashioned page-turner, but apparently that didn't make it any easier to write.
Jenny, I have to begin because Alex Schwartz's wonderful profile of you in The New Yorker begins with you talking about a subject that seems to be so dear to the heart of so many writers, which is how horrible it is to write, how hard it is to write, how if you could be doing anything else in this world, including running up a mountain barefoot, you'd rather be doing that than write. What is it about writing that's so hard if you're talking to people who are non-writers?
It's such a good question. One of the strange things about it is that I find that the horrors that I experience with each book, and they're usually temporary. There's one phase in each book that's usually really bad. And when I'm in it, I think it will never end. And then after it does end, I kind of start to forget it. So it's always a little hard, but I'm close enough to this that I do remember. The really bad phase with this one was when I had spent a year and a half on a first draft. Well, that's a very long time to spend on a handwritten first draft. Typed it up and read it, and I felt like what I needed to know and do to possibly make this book even passable, not to speak of something that might actually please anyone much, but just to make it anything better than an embarrassment, felt like more than I was capable of. So I think that there's a feeling of impossibility, a kind of no exit sense that the way back is just as long as the way forward, but you can't find your way forward. So and I think this is where the isolation of writing is really difficult because, you know, my husband's in the theater and I know they have down moments sometimes working on a show, but it's collaborative. So everyone's there to kind of bolster each other up and also just consult with each other about whatever the problem is. I hadn't really shown this to anyone. It was not fit to be shown. And so I was in the echo chamber of my own head contemplating what it would really mean if I actually just didn't have another book. And that quickly becomes, you know, because fiction has such a magical quality to it in the sense that I think none of us really knows where it comes from. It's like dreaming. Well, what if you just stop dreaming? There's no one to promise us that that won't happen.
So, but you've done it before. This is your fifth novel?
Yes.
And that doesn't give you any confidence that the next novel, this novel, Manhattan Beach, is going to be in any way anything other than a disaster.
You would think it would. I think the reason it doesn't is twofold. One is I do forget how much I worry about each one. And that's nice in that I embark happily on the next, but it's bad in that I forget that I may have been just that worried before and
like
it did work out.
Like forgetting the pain of childbirth.
Yeah, I think it actually, that's not a bad analogy. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that my books tend to be very different from each other. And particularly what excites me is to try to really renounce what I've done the last time. And I really thrive on a feeling of change, of almost being ripped away from what I know. That seems to be what kind of wakes up all of my nerves and gets me interested and excited.
But what brought you to this book exactly, Manhattan Beach? We're in wartime New York, the Second World War. How did this story start for you?
My books pretty much always start the same way, with an interest or a kind of inclination toward a particular time and place. So I guess you would say they begin with atmosphere. So as I thought about New York during World War II, I began looking at a lot of photographs like Fenninger and other kind of amazing atmospheric photos of New York at that time. And what was immediately striking was just the omnipresence of the waterfront. I mean, it was a port. And I had lived in New York for many years by then and barely been on the water or thought about it. And that quickly led me to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was a really important place on the New York waterfront during World War II. It was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships, period. It built 17 battleships and repaired 5,000 ships. I mean, it was huge. I had never been there, and I live maybe 5 blocks away.
5 blocks from your scene.
Yeah. So that was fascinating, and I visited it, and it was really thrilling to go there. It felt very secret and hidden, and kind of decaying and old, but also full of new things.
You did a lot of interviewing around the Navy Yard, people of a certain age or people who are now gone. Did they suggest characters as well as evoking the scene of reality?
I think that there were all kinds of little details that came through from those interviews that I'm so indebted to these women, especially women that I talked to for. For example, there's a crucial moment when Anna makes a friend, and that friendship begins with Anna watching this very beautiful girl fall off a bicycle. And that was a scene that was described to me by quite a beautiful 80-something-year-old whom I was interviewing, and she described this incredibly embarrassing day. It had stayed with her all those years when she rode along a pier on a bike and then slid on some sand, and only then realized that the ship that she was alongside was just lined with sailors, and they were all howling with laughter at her. And she said she never rode a bike in the Navy Yard again. There are lots of little details like that.
One of the great parts of the novel is its bravura opening, which reminded me in some ways of Billy Bathgate, the way that there's a kind of great mob organized crime opening to a novel that has that stands on its own as this piece of exciting fiction. The thing that comes with mob fiction is a whole background of genre movies and television shows. Was that something that was in your wheelhouse? Were you a big fan of all that stuff?
Very much so. I love that stuff. I mean, and there's so much mob stuff going so far back. I mean, I love The Sopranos, but I also love the really early mobster movies. And I also have a bit of a familial relationship to some of this in that my grandfather was a police officer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you come from
a mobster.
Family.
Well, in Chicago, sometimes there's not a gigantic difference.
Exactly.
But I'm not saying that about my grandfather. He was real police, as they say. But what that means in Chicago might not be quite the same as what it means anywhere else. And it may not have been the same then as now. But my grandfather was President Truman's bodyguard when he would come to the Chicago area. My grandfather and his partner, dating back to before he was president, but they were all very friendly, and there are tons of lovely pictures of all of them laughing together. So he was interested. My uncle tells a funny story about watching my grandfather outside some kind of civic building, and my grandfather was sort of looking around, kind of a little narrow-eyed, and my uncle said, "What are you doing?" And my grandfather said, "Trying to separate the good guys from the bad guys."
If I remember right, isn't your book dedicated to?
It's dedicated to my uncle, right, Robert Egan, and to my siblings, because my father's no longer living. It is certainly my first attempt to connect to my ethnicity, such as it is, as an Irish American, because that side of the family is, feels its Irish Americanness very strongly.
You don't usually, so far as I know, as a reader, an ardent reader, use autobiographical. You're not that direct in the autobiographical sense, but here you've got a character, Anna's father, Eddie Kerrigan, who goes missing early in the novel, and your own biological father was largely absent in your childhood. How does that reality play with your creative work, if at all?
Since I feel like I'm very bored when I start to touch on my own life, it always sneaks up on me in my work, because if I think I'm working on that, I don't want to work on it. But I feel that that terrible feeling of familiarity comes over me, a kind of dullness. It just feels not exciting. It doesn't feel like an escape. And really, this all is a huge escape for me. I just love the feeling of being in two worlds at once, my life and this other life.
How did you first experience that?
I think as a little kid, I loved playing imaginative games with other friends where we just played characters and enacted sequences as those characters, and they went on over years. But there were other kids in our building, and I remember being pretty controlling. There was one moment where someone said, "I want to be the father," and I said, "No, the father died," interestingly, to your question. And the mother of this kid said, "Now, wait a minute. Why can't he play the father if he wants to?" So I was kind of pushy. I lived for those games. I found them utterly transporting.
When did you start writing those games down, in a sense?
I was not really a serious writer until college.
You wanted to be a doctor.
I wanted to be a doctor for a really long time, and I loved science and I loved biology. I'm still interested in all that.
But you've also gotten a reputation as a kind of, you'll forgive me, but a seer, somebody who makes predictions about things that are coming down the pike, about technology and other matters. Do you accept that?
I think that Jane Smiley used a phrase when I was listening to her speak recently called the energy of logic. I love that. You know, logic has its own sort of energy. And I think if you follow that, you reach certain conclusions that often do mirror reality because the logic is the same in both contexts. I've sometimes imagined things that came true, but usually so shortly thereafter that I'm not sure I really should get a lot of credit. I mean, you know, books take so long to publish that half the time the things have already happened by the time my book comes out.
Don't you wonder why it takes so long for the damn books to be published? I don't understand it.
I spend more time wondering why it takes me so damn long to write them.
I wonder how you feel about readership. I remember interviewing Philip Roth years ago. His overall prediction was that the audience for literary fiction, in a world where we don't just have one screen or one radio, we have proliferating screens, is, in his view, and he's old, is that it's become like epic poetry, or it's just become such a narrow, specialized readership. Do you get the sense that literary fiction is something that's winnowing and diminishing in its importance in the culture or not?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't really ask that question because I feel like that's not a problem I can solve. The way I think about it is I have to write work that is of interest to those people, that synthesizes this same culture with all those screens, or gives us, I mean, this book is probably more of an escapist book. I feel strongly that if I do my job well, I will find readers. And that is a problem that seems more easy to tackle than a cultural problem about screens ultimately, you know, reducing.
Which is beyond your control.
I mean, one thing is for sure. Fiction writers have to do an excellent job. That is the only reason people are going to read us.
Jenny, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan is the author of Manhattan Beach and other novels. You can find all the stories and essays she's published at The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org.
I'm good. How are you?
Doreen St. Felix became a New Yorker staff writer earlier this year, and she's written on subjects ranging from Justin Bieber to gentrification to the racial politics of The Bachelorette. She's been singing the praises of a rapper named Cardi B, and I asked Doreen to come by and tell me about that and a couple of other things she's been into these days. So, Doreen, I just want to get clued into what you're thinking about and looking at and hearing these days, and I have a premonition that one of the things might be something that you wrote about recently.
Yes. So Cardi B recently became the second female solo rapper in history to hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
Who was first?
Lauryn Hill.
There you go.
And that was in 1998.
So of those two people, I've at least seen one live.
I'm guessing it's Lauryn Hill.
Yeah, that's, you got it. What should we hear from Cardi B?
We should listen to Bodak Yellow. Bitch, I make bloody moves. Now she say, she gon' do what or who? Let's find out and see. Cardi B, you know where I'm at. You know where I be. You in the club just to party. I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them banks so much I know they tired of me.
We can get about 40% of this on the radio.
So Cardi B is from the South Bronx, and she is really interesting because she did not become famous as a musician. She became famous on Instagram and Vine in 2013, early 2014.
Why?
At first, she was just another girl who was making funny videos that people used as memes, as response gifs, that kind of thing. But then she actually started building her own following, and that's because she's just a miracle of streaming. Bodak Yellow was supposed to introduce us to Cardi B, right. But it ended up being a blockbuster. It's the music story of the year. I think that a lot of industry people aren't sure of how to integrate streaming into the way that we understand what listeners are into. But Cardi B has shown us that's where the money is, and that's how you create a community of people who are willing to, you know, build your profile in a way that is nearly unprecedented, I'd say.
So now we make a rapid transition from Cardi B to what? What else? What's been on your mind?
We should talk about Chopped Junior.
Oh, my wife loves this.
Oh, she does.
Oh, my God. Oh, my
so
God.
So maybe you know a little bit about
I
what
give her
we'll
a slightly
about.
Despairing look when I see her watching it, I have to admit.
So Chopped Junior has the same premise as the original Chopped, which is to say there are three rounds in which four contestants have to make an appetizer, a main, and a dessert from four random ingredients.
Now it's like chili peppers, vanilla ice cream,
exactly.
A hot dog, and something else.
Yeah, and like yeah. sardines.
Yeah.
But Chopped Junior features contestants as young as nine.
And you must use paneer cheese.
Paneer cheese, what?
It's just so soothing to watch nine-year-olds
screw
sous
vide.
That's the thing, though. They're phenomenally...
Nine-year-olds are sous viding
yes,
things?
Yes, they're phenomenally able. They're not at all scared of using all of these like really fancy right. appliances in the kitchen. And sometimes the food looks good. Not all the time.
What do they make?
Well, there's a really great example of this girl using a lollipop and melting it down with water to make a kind of savory sweet sauce.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna crush up the apple candies and put them in a pan, and I'm adding mint to the dish because it'll add a light herbiness to it. Dulce de leche. Yeah,
so. Lollipop reduction.
Yes, exactly.
Drizzled lollipop reduction. I'm guessing after a long night of watching Chopped, you have other things on your mind. What would be your third pick?
So I was in New Orleans this past weekend, and while I was there, I was walking down this beautiful tree-lined block, and I saw this home, and it had flags on it, and I wondered, like, what is happening? And in front of it, I saw a plaque, and it actually explained that Edgar Degas lived in that home for 5 months between the fall of 1872 and the beginning of 1873.
Wow.
Yeah, so he actually is part American. His mother was a French Creole. Her name was Celestine. And she lived in New Orleans before she moved to France. And Degas did not make much of a splash as an artist in France. And then he went to New Orleans, where two of his brothers were living. And he absolutely fell in love with the city. He started calling himself a son of Louisiana. And he has this really famous painting called A Cotton Office in New Orleans, which you can see here. And it actually features his uncle and two of his brothers. That's one of his brothers right there.
Reading a newspaper.
Yeah,
right
he's
in the
reading.
Middle of the canvas.
He's reading the Daily Picayune. And his uncle was very wealthy through the cotton trade. And what's so interesting about this painting is it captures a culture in decline. So these French Creoles, you know, they still spoke French. They didn't really want to think of New Orleans as being an American city at that point. And not long after this, his uncle's business collapsed and New Orleans ends up becoming the city that we're more familiar with today.
And this is after Emancipation Proclamation.
Exactly.
So it's a political painting
yes.
as well as a family one. It's an amazing thing. I've never seen it other than reproduced. It's a beautiful picture.
Yeah. And now,
and you just happened upon it walking down the street.
I just happened upon it. I mean, it's a perfect New Orleans story. And it actually is a bed and breakfast now.
Perfect. Then you could have had lollipop reduction on your
my Creole omelet.
Exactly. Doreen, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Doreen's writing on, among other things, competitive double Dutch jump roping at NewYorkerRadio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now we're going to close the show today with a rare and exclusive peek into a forgotten corner of musical history. You may well know Roz Chast as a cartoonist. She's got a very recognizable style of squiggly lines and neurotic characters. Her book, Can't We Please Talk About Something More Pleasant, about dealing with her aging parents, was a bestseller a couple of years ago, and it won awards that don't usually go to books of cartoons. But here's something you don't know about Roz Chast. She and Patricia Marks, a staff writer here, play in a band. Not just any band. A band with an amazing musical pedigree. They influenced some of the biggest names in music in the 60s and beyond. But they were also a little too far ahead of the curve for the mainstream. So now, for the first time ever, Patricia Marks and Roz Chast tell their story.
I'm Patty Marks.
I'm Roz Chast.
And we are the Ooklier Meltdown. You may not remember us, but you probably do. We were very, very big in the 60s when we were the Daily Pukulelis. Now we're the Ooklier Meltdown, and we are coming back. We're practicing.
For our return tour as Ooklier or Ooklier Meltdown, because we don't know how to, we're still debating on how to pronounce it. Mm-hmm.
We've gotten some experts.
Yeah.
But even they don't know. So, eons ago, I was playing with Bobby Zimmerman.
Bobby Zimmerman. And I was with Joni.
You were with Joni. We were both too good for the rest of our band. It was very clear. I mean, it's the reason we got kicked out of the bands, really. Yeah.
Well, they were good also, but I felt like the way that they were good was a different way than we were good.
Well, we had personality. Yeah. They had talent.
Yes.
Which, okay, each to its own, right?
Yeah.
We were really, just didn't belong with them. We had kind of a
And nobody wanted us in their band. I would go up to bands like Iron Butterfly.
Yeah.
You know, Jimi Hendrix Experience. I went there.
I gave Joan Baez two ideas, which really made her. She was wearing, had a pixie haircut. I said, go long, Joni. And then when she began, she would just say 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, Joni, what you should do is flip your hair upside down, the way your long hair, after you grow it, and just say, this song's for David. He's in jail doing what he thinks is right. And if you notice, that's how she opened all the time.
So we got together and we realized that we were very simpatico and we liked the same songs. They were all public domain.
We liked the same color ukulele.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So we formed the Daily Pukuleles.
Yes, and we got very big for a while.
Yeah,
and
that was, we got very big, and then.
But then Paul stole all our money.
Paul, our manager, stole all our money. We didn't have any, luckily, but
he stole what
we had. He stole our money. He stole all the money we were gonna get.
Yeah. And that was when things did get bad, though, because then we had to go into rehab.
Mm-hmm. Which we liked.
We learned a lot. We made ashtrays.
We have some of the ashtrays from rehab.
Yeah, yeah. We met some interesting people. What was our first breakout hit? Boy, it was a long time ago.
Was it Star Spangled Banner? Was it...
I thought it was Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday,
yeah.
We wrote Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday to you.
Yeah, that was, it's so
and now that we've
universal,
made,
really.
It is universal.
Because if you're alive, if you're listening.
Right. Well, except for the people who have unhappy birthdays.
That's true. I mean, I don't want to force. Maybe we should change it to like
happy birthday.
Birthday to you. Yeah,
whatever birthday to you.
Whatever birthday. Because, you know, you don't want to pressure anybody. Mm-hmm. Right. It's like, you know.
Disappointed birthday we could do.
Yeah. Neutral.
Neutral birthday.
Neutral birthday.
Yeah. Have a birthday to you.
Yeah.
We're working on Wrinkle, Wrinkle, Little Face.
Yes, yes. Wrinkle, Wrinkle, Little Face.
Also, we're working another.
Wrinkles form in every place.
Right. will you?
Wrinkles high, lines wrinkles erase. Low.
You want to play something?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Should we play Camptown Races, also called Camptown Ladies?
Yeah, yeah.
Which we should say that we rewrote, and if you listen carefully to the lyrics, if you can hear them, you will see why. And. I usually introduce it because I don't have a singing voice, but I have a talking voice.
You have a very, good talking voice.
I was in a talking choir.
My talking voice can get kind of like panicky and screechy.
Well, okay.
So, okay.
So this is On Your Mark, Get Set, Go.
Camptown ladies, we don't know, do-da, do-da, who they are or where they go, all the do-da day.
It was on our first album, Ocular Accidents, which was our breakout album, really.
Yeah. We had a lot of records.
Right.
Duck and Cover.
Right.
Famous Duck and Cover.
Learn Ukulele in Your Sleep.
You too can play ukulele.
But not as well as we can.
Yeah. That was the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
How to Make Love to a Man with a Ukulele.
Right. That wasn't Beethoven, that was us.
Crazy because then we were touring all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being on the road, it's really rough.
Right. And it's also rough, confusing. You're always like, do you turn left? Do you turn right? That is the hard thing about the road.
I know. And you know how I feel about driving. I mean, I didn't learn until after we were on the road. So a lot of times when we were on the road,
We were lost a lot on the road.
We were lost. And I was
a problem.
And I would be like screaming while we were like merging into traffic because. When I merge into traffic, I have to really scream. And I was taking a lot of drugs back then because being on the road was so
scary. Made you nervous, right?
It made me very, very nervous. Sometimes I didn't even know if I was on the road. Am I dreaming or are we actually driving on the road? Are we really on the road?
Or maybe we're just blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
Episode. Oh,
yes.
that was something.
Going electric.
Well, we did.
Fights.
We did. Our manager, Paul, who took our money,
said
we had to go electric. So we went to your house and we set up in the driveway, and we didn't really know how to. If you've seen a ukulele, there's
how
no place to really plug it in. There's no place to plug it in.
Yeah, exactly.
So we thought...
We went to the hardware store.
We went to the hardware store.
We bought extension
batteries, extension
everything,
cords.
Everything
no
electric
place
that
to
we
plug
could
it
buy.
In. So you know what we did? We were pretty good students in elementary school. You can make a battery with a baked potato or a raw potato.
A raw potato.
Well, that was our first mistake, baked, but okay.
Yeah.
At least we didn't go mashed. We got a raw potato. We set up the wires and we tried to go electric.
We tried to plug the potato into the ukulele.
Then our manager told us, all right, if you can't go electric, you should break some ukuleles on stage. So we're a little afraid of that because of our shoes.
Yes.
We didn't really want to damage our shoes.
I also didn't want to get like a cut
because
I had read about sepsis.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ukulele Disco? You don't remember that?
Yeah.
It was like we were at Studio 54 every night. That was like we were very heavily into that whole scene mm-hmm. for a little while because ukuleles were like, there was this brief moment somewhere around like November 18th to November 20th, 1974, where ukuleles were kind of
I think. Well, then we tried, was it Saturday? No, not Saturday night. It was Sunday Night Rash.
Sunday Night Rash.
Sunday
yeah,
Night Rash.
Yeah, we tried. We tried. It didn't really, you know, I don't know why. Maybe like it passed its peak at that point. Yeah. People were too busy with, I don't know, Casey and the Sunshine Band.
We couldn't get into some of the discos because of the bouncer.
That's
true. The bouncer didn't let us in.
We were too short.
Yeah, we were too short.
Yeah. And the glasses. I think that was trouble. Mm-hmm. We should not have worn the glasses.
Right. And they were always inspecting our... And ukuleles.
For drugs, because we did used to keep our drugs in the ukulele, mm-hmm. along with the gum and the tissues and, you know,
and the
change of underwear.
Pencil.
Pencils, sketch pads. You could put a little sketch pad mm-hmm. in there. You can carry this as a purse.
Yeah. We never broke up. That's probably why we weren't a bigger hit.
Yeah, and I do really hope that we peak yet again as ukular, whichever we decide it's going to be.
Right. Well, we're doing the best we can that doesn't involve work.
We have.
Do you want to play
a weemawack? Yeah.
You say weemawack. I say weemaway.
It is weemaway.
I didn't know.
That's wrong.
We didn't know for the longest time what weemaway was.
And we
still don't. But I had the theory that it's what you do all the doo-dah day.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
Chorus. On your mark. Get set, go.
A whim away, 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 a whim away.
First, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first, and it may be the last time. Patty Marks and Roz Chast on vocals and ukulele. The disco ukulele remix is courtesy of Terrence Bernardo. That's it for today. I'm David Remnick. Next week, I'll be talking with another musical icon, a real one this time, Annie Clark, who performs under the name St. Vincent. Please join us. Until then, have a great week.
The end. We're working on some... new lyrics for this that was near New Jersey, the great New Jersey. Chris Christie sleeps tonight.
Yeah, because we like being topical.
Yeah, it's we like important. Being topical. We have a great rhyme with Obama and pajamas, but we need a story to go with it.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.